Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Roderick, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 295 for Tuesday, the 5th day of September, 2017. Today, the former president of the NAACP, Ben Jealous, talks about why he joined the field of candidates running for the Democratic nomination for Maryland governor in 2018. In a session we recorded last week, Ben Jealous criticizes the incumbent governor, Larry Hogan, for showing only recent interest in Baltimore's severe problem with violent crime. He also notes Maryland's decline among states with the top-ranked educational systems and pledges to increase funding for schools to recommended levels. We'll have 25 minutes with Ben Jealous. I wanted more, but his schedule was apparently tight. After we hear first from Paula Gallagher, Baltimore County librarian and Roughly Speaking book critic. This week, Paula recommends a work of nonfiction set in what once was the richest rural county in the nation, on Virginia's Eastern Shore.
Dan, this week I have a nonfiction title called American Fire, Love, Arson, and Life in a Vanishing Land by Monica Hesse. This is an expansion of a feature written by Monica Hesse, who is a Washington Post reporter and feature writer. The interesting thing about this story is that she's weaving together multiple strands. This takes place on the eastern shore of Virginia in Accomack County, and it begins in mid-November of 2012. And the story covers the 5 months over which 67 fires were lit. And these were fires that were set in abandoned buildings largely. And so what she does, very interestingly, is gives you a little bit of the history of Accomack County, which was once vibrant but now economically depressed, lack of industry, business, therefore lack of jobs, and the complicated love story of the arsonists, Charlie Smith and Tanya Bundick, both working class, both with struggles in their lives from drug addiction to single parenting of special needs kids, to coming out of a really abusive childhood. She also tells the story of the townspeople and the volunteer firefighters who come together to fight the fires, trying to figure out who is setting them and why, the rallying together people around a cause who really heretofore had nothing really to come together over. She puts together not a whodunit story, but a whydunit story. And it's fascinating and a good, compelling piece of storytelling. She's taking a look at the struggles of the working class, drug addiction, you know, having dreams but not the means to make them come true the way you want them to, dysfunctional families, dates at Walmart, true love at the roadside bar called Shuckers, and the things you'll do for love beyond your wildest imagination. She takes you from the scenes of the crime to the courtroom. It's a solid true crime narrative as well as a commentary on the forgotten. This is a book that I listened to on audiobook with an excellent narrator, and I highly recommend it in that format. Again, it's American Fire by Monica Hesse.
Paula Gallagher works at the Pikesville branch of the Baltimore County Public Library. She recommends a book each week on the podcast.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogix is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
And coming up at the Ivy on Tuesday, September 12th, Matthew Crenson, author of Baltimore, A Political History. We featured that book in a series of Roughly Speaking episodes last month. If you would like to hear Matt Crenson in person, he'll be speaking and signing copies of the book at the Ivy on September 12th. That event is at 7 p.m. Okay, speaking of politics, we continue our conversations with candidates for elected office in Maryland's June 2018 primary. Today, Ben Jealous, a longtime community organizer and activist, a Columbia graduate and Rhodes Scholar. Ben Jealous was just 35 when he became president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. In the 5 years he spent at its Baltimore headquarters, he was credited with returning the NAACP to relevance. re-energizing the organization, and improving its finances. He's 44 now and based in Baltimore with a venture capital firm, Kapor Capital, which funds tech startups, many of them founded by women and people of color. Ben Jealous, whose mother grew up in Baltimore, lives in Anne Arundel County now. He is divorced and has two children who live with him part-time. Today's interview was cut short a bit because of an unexpected, at least on my part, scheduling issue, so we didn't get to everything, but we got to a lot, including some of Ben Jealous's criticisms of the incumbent governor, Larry Hogan. Jealous has promised to be more outspoken than Hogan in opposing the policies of President Trump, especially on environmental issues such as the leadership of the Environmental Protection Agency and the president's proposed defunding of federal programs to clean up the Chesapeake Bay. Last week, Ben Jealous was among those complaining about Hogan's decision to close to the public a meeting of the Baltimore City Criminal Justice Coordinating Council to discuss the city's crime problem. After the meeting, Hogan said he would propose so-called truth in sentencing legislation in Annapolis, part of his recent posturing on Baltimore judges and the sentences they give violent offenders. So we'll hear from Ben Jealous on that subject and others, including funding for public education. So Ben Jealous, it's nice to see you again. Welcome back to the podcast.
Always good to see you, Dan.
Why are you running for governor?
I'm running for governor because Maryland's been good to my family for generations, and I want to make sure that it's good to working families for generations to come.
That's pretty succinct.
Yeah.
What got you around to thinking about this?
Well, I think like a lot of folks, I spent the days and months after Trump came into office to walk around saying the Serenity Prayer every day. And a key concept of the Serenity Prayer is to know the things you can change. And one thing we can change is getting, frankly, the working families of Maryland back in charge of our state's agenda again. I mean, we outnumber Republicans, Democrats and Republicans 2-1, but we don't even control our governorship. And so it occurred to me that we could do it. We sat down and realized that we could run a unifying campaign that would pull the Democratic Party together and take back our governorship and get back to doing what we were doing just a few years ago, you know, when it was possible to get big things done in our state.
Well, let me press you on that a little bit more.
Sure.
What about Trump and what happened in that election got you thinking about being a governor of Maryland? Was it something in particular or was it just the whole thing?
I had been on a journey since the uprisings. As you know, my family's journey starts in Upton. Granddad came up to work on the B&O Railroad. Grandmother and my mom came up about 6 months later. They moved into the McCullough Homes housing projects. Grandma went to work for Planned Parenthood in 1940. A generation later, my grandparents were waving goodbye to me at Dulles Airport as I flew off to be a Rhodes Scholar in England. My family's been blessed. We know what it takes to go from raising one child in the housing projects and tenements of West Baltimore to sending the next generation, saying that child's child off to Oxford, be a Rhodes Scholar. But you can't explain it without a context in which government is on the side of working people, social movements are getting stronger and holding it accountable. And so there I was, you know, a couple of years ago on my way to church at St. James Lafayette Square, where I was baptized. My family's gone now for 4 or 5 generations. And just stopped the car and looked around and realized there were a lot of obstacles that have been put in the place of working families in recent decades that, frankly, we could remove. But it would take actually getting back to practicing a sort of politic that, yes, is on fire about advancing civil rights, but is also on fire about ending poverty and expanding opportunity.
And you should be able to sell that in Maryland. Maryland is, in the main, a progressive state.
That's right. Well, you know, I've had some remarkable moments. You know, we're getting a great response in Baltimore City and Prince George's County. You might expect that from the former president of the NAACP. You can't take anybody for granted, but I think, you know, a lot in the chattering class of politics here sort of assume. But, man, we're also getting a great response in Catonsville. We're getting a great response in Eastern Shore. We're getting a great response in Cumberland.
You're not running into people who say, oh, Larry Hogan's doing a great job.
Folks in like new cars tend to say that. Most of Maryland doesn't drive a brand new car, you know? And so folks in like old trucks, Folks who buy, you know, a used car as a new car. Frankly, their question, they say, like, how can you help my family? And when you start talking about what we can do to end massive student debt, and pay for it by ending mass incarceration, make our community colleges free, but not stop there, make sure that the casino money and the lottery money is actually used to expand funding for education, not just to replace the old sources. You get people's attention. You start talking about building the economy. I mean, since the uprisings, I've invested in two companies in Baltimore from my desk at Cape Work Capital over on East Redwood Street. And frankly, I spent a lot of time trying to move a factory here that chose not to move here. Ultimately, Dan, because the healthcare costs were volatile. And you get people's attention.
Aren't they everywhere?
Not in Canada, where we were trying to move them from.
Oh, right. Okay.
Ironically. Yeah. And so I've found that if you just talk to people about the issues, you get surprising numbers of Republicans and independents paying attention. I was out in Catonsville on the 4th of July, and, you know, Catonsville is a beautiful town, right? You got every faith, you got every race, like hardworking people. And working down the sidewalk on the 4th of July, I figured out I could get to twice as many 4th of July parades, by the way. If I didn't march in any of them, I just marched down the sidewalk and talked to people. And I'm talking to this guy in his 21228 lacrosse t-shirt. He's nodding his head a lot. And at the end, he says, "Well, Mr. Jealous, we got a challenge here." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I'm a Republican." He said, "But you've given me a lot to think about." He said, I got to tell you, man, I'll be paying close attention. You got me thinking about voting for a Democrat for the first time." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "You know, the whole time I was listening to you, all I could hear in my ear was my favorite line from my favorite poet." I said, "Brother, what's your favorite line from your favorite poet?" He said, "We have more in common than we have uncommon." I said, "That sounds familiar. Who's your favorite poet?" He said, "Dr. Maya Angelou." The moment you got white male Republicans in Catonsville quoting Maya Angelou to you in response to your policy platform.
Wow. But, you know, Trump is not very popular in Maryland. The polls indicate that.
Yep.
And the election indicated that. It doesn't surprise me that you run into that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it is a progressive state. We have conservative Republicans, obviously, who made Larry Hogan possible.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of others who are sort of in the middle, a lot of independents. And what do they want? You can be confused nationally
sure.
with that question. What do people want?
Sure.
They elected Donald Trump. So it's very confusing. So why'd you elect him? But in Maryland, maybe it's clearer what people want.
People's expectations are more clear at kind of the lower the level of government, right? So I don't know what to expect from Congress. It's one of the reasons why I'm focused on state government. They've been stuck. They've been at a standstill. 10% of the bills that get passed are for the renaming of post offices and the minting of commemorative coins. They're at one quarter of the productivity of the do-nothing Congress of 47-49 for the last like three Congresses in a row. If we're going to fix problems, we're going to fix them at the state level. And when you listen to folks, people want to make sure that the schools work. They work for every kid. There's a good teacher in every classroom. We want to make sure that our education, frankly, is connected to industry and to job opportunities, that young people come out of high school career ready, which means that you're going to have to make sure that we're teaching every kid coding, but we're also pushing the trades back into high school. Folks want to make sure that if you work and you work 40 hours a week in America, you can provide the most basic necessities for your family. You don't have to think about working three jobs and literally choosing, Dan, between starving your children or neglecting them. You know, folks want to make sure, frankly, that they feel safer and that our criminal justice policies are actually based on the evidence of what works and not just trotting out some old failed policy because maybe it works as a good PR strategy, which is what Governor Hogan was doing this week.
Well, I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Since you just brought it up, I'll just move right there. The latest thing we heard from Governor Hogan is that he wants truth in sentencing.
Yeah.
He had a meeting here in Baltimore City about the crime rate in Baltimore City and what can be done about it.
Yep.
So there's two things about that I wanted to ask you. What came out of it was a pledge from the governor to propose legislation that would be called truth in sentencing, which to me it means doing away with parole.
That's exactly right.
If you're sentenced to 10 years for an armed robbery, you serve 10 years. In Maryland, we have a parole system.
You know, and one of the groups of people who will get less safe day one that you do that will be our corrections officers. Because good time incentives are a way of, frankly, making the whole prison safer. And what we've seen is when you take that away, prisons tend to get more violent over time because people have no hope. You can't hold that carrot out there.
So you would keep parole?
Yep. The reality is that this is just one more failed war on drug strategy that ended up bankrupting states around the country. And the reason that these laws were first passed or accelerated was that the federal government agreed to subsidize the cost. The federal government's not doing that anymore. And so what Hogan's, doing when he says this, he's writing a big check with his mouth. Those dollars would be better spent on getting former gang members to actually work the streets, helping to squash beef so people don't get shot.
That's safe streets you're describing.
Yes.
You support expanding safe streets?
They've done it in New York City to great effect. The biggest housing projects in the city, New York City, Queensbridge, went about 500 days with no shootings. They used to have shootings weekly.
Well, there's evidence of it here.
I mean,
the Cherry Hill sector of safe streets, Park Heights, they went several months without any homicides.
No, that's exactly right. But what we're doing here is like a small pilot program.
Oh, yeah, just,
that needs
it's just
to be
in small sectors.
Citywide.
Okay, so you would support that.
Yeah, and so that's what New York did. That's different is that there, we're at sort of stage one, which is the experimental phase with safe streets here. In New York City, they actually decided to pump a bunch of city dollars into it and expand it much more aggressively. We need to expand it more aggressively. We need to make sure, quite frankly, that we're really that the strategy is being driven by people who really understand the streets well. And frankly, we need to look at a similar approach to dealing with crime victims. Typically, victims get served through an office that's connected to some form of law enforcement. They begun at the U.S. Department of Justice under Obama at the end, they began to look at actually creating a program where you would hire crime victims in high crime neighborhoods to get victim services to victims, whether or not they reported right away. You have people, they may have been raped, they may have been robbed, they're traumatized. The first thing they need is help. And if you say, well, we're not going to help you until you, agree to testify, that's not fair. And it doesn't actually, you typically have about five times as many crimes victims in a given area as you have crimes that are reported. And all those crime victims should be served. And when you're serving all of them, you ultimately get better cooperation with law enforcement. But you've got to treat it, frankly, the way that those of us who have more resources, conduct our lives, which is first we're going to take care of you as a victim, and then we're going to talk to you about how you might work with law enforcement to make sure that this doesn't happen to somebody else.
The second question I had about the summit on crime that the governor just held, he invited judges to be there. He said he wanted to question judges about why, in gun cases in particular, or in the case of gun charges, why so many of those sentences are suspended by judges. So he wanted to get real specific with judges about these sentencing practices in Baltimore City. Chief Judge said, no, we're not going to participate in that because we're not supposed to be influenced by politics. And there's a separation issue here. So how did you feel about that?
Well, look, I think I get the impetus to refer to it as a summit and sort of treat him like a prodigal son because he's been AWOL from the meeting since he came into office. But the reality is he just showed up to a meeting that he's had a seat at that he's never attended before, not during the uprisings.
Yeah, summit does dress it up. I apologize. It's not like let's have a summit on crime when it actually is
it's a standing meeting.
It's a standing meeting of this council that he attended and wanted judges to attend.
For the first time, and he's had a seat on it the whole time.
Yeah, and judges do attend this, but he wanted to question or grill judges about their sentencing practices.
And I think, quite frankly, the judges may have showed up if A, it was an open meeting, because it usually is, that's what they usually show up to, and if B, if he had showed up before, but here we are, crime has surged, 2015, he didn't ever show up, uprisings didn't show up, surge 2016, he never showed up, surge 2017, doesn't show up until it starts to really get into re-election season, then suddenly he shows up, and he closes a meeting that's typically an open meeting.
Did you try to get into that meeting?
Yeah, no, I went, You know, I saw council people getting turned away. But what was probably most alarming to me, Dan, was our state attorney general comes out and says that the governor's proposal wasn't discussed in the meeting.
This truth in sentencing proposal.
It seemed like the governor planned on making a proposal and yet did not feel comfortable discussing it with the public, so he closed the meeting, and did not feel comfortable discussing it with the leaders who attended the closed meeting. I mean, it just strikes me as somewhere between compulsive and disingenuous. Either you plan...
Or naive.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's new to this, right?
Please.
A lot of us are not new to
when
the
I've
idea.
I've been governor for 3 years. Don't say that I'm new to it.
No, I mean, the whole issue of truth in sentencing, of mandatory minimums, of no parole, all these criminal justice issues, is not something the governor spent a lot of time on.
Well, he should have. You know, I mean, it's the only way that we're going to make folks across the state feel safer is if we ultimately have a governor who's concerned about safety in every part of our state. And in these last 3 years, we've seen violence surge in our most populated areas, especially Baltimore. We've seen deaths from ODs surge across the state. But here's the thing. Crime was already a problem when the governor started office, and so he should have come in with a plan. I don't know.
Well, he's not mayor of Baltimore.
Yeah, but, I mean, let's be – look, my grandfather was on law enforcement. He was a probation officer in Baltimore for 30 years. He'll tell you the only way he would have told you the only way things get better in Baltimore is if you have a governor who's engaged. No, you are not mayor, but the flip side is last time I checked, the governor and the state have an outside role in the policing of Baltimore.
The governor sent the National Guard here during the unrest of April 27th, 2015, yeah. Claimed in meetings that he had saved the city.
And which is insane.
That he received little thanks for it. Within a couple of months after that, when there was all this talk about what Baltimore needed, what the trauma that we had just been through and what it had revealed, as if we didn't know what the problems were, but there was more talk about it.
Yep.
He kills the Red Line, a transit project, an economic development project that had been in the works for 10 going on 11 years and had some $900 million in federal funding tied up with it.
And $288 million spent, as I recall.
Yeah, to design it and hold meetings with the public. Okay, so that happened, and then several months later, we have a decision on State Center, another major redevelopment project here. So it sounds like I'm feeding Ben jealous, you know, campaign material here, but this is all stuff I've written and expressed.
Yes, and so, you and I do have similar views. I've also said all this at press conferences.
I don't. Right? Where is the evidence? Where is the beef on the governor and Baltimore? That's so...
Well, and that's just it, right? And please don't come to our city to an open meeting, close it, not talk about what you're planning to do, and then act like this is just about law enforcement. Because the reality is, you know, as Father Greg Boyle, great Catholic priest, said a long time ago, nothing stops a bullet like a job. There's a whole context here. My family's from West Baltimore. I was meeting the other day with families out in Dundalk. The factory's left all of us. And we have legions of men, white and black, in our city who really have no career vision beyond working in factories that don't exist still. And we've got to deal with it, you know, actually attack this by strengthening our schools, strengthening our economy, not just so that we have low rates of unemployment for those who are looking for jobs, but we actually get into the ranks of discouraged workers, you know, high rates of joblessness for men, again, in these kind of old factory neighborhoods throughout our city. You know, and you have to have transportation that works. Right? We have senior citizens walking 6 blocks in the summertime to a bus stop. You got people with this Baltimore Link actually literally passed by yesterday while we were locked out, who used to take 2 buses. Now they take 3. You've got to make education work. You've got to make the economy work. You've got to make jobs pay. And you got to make transportation work. If you want to create a context in which crime can go down and stay down in a sustained way, the governor has disinvested in all of those things.
Let's talk about education for a minute. I got an email yesterday from someone, I don't know where they live, but I had the feeling they didn't live in Baltimore City. The focus of their criticism was Baltimore City and the failure of the schools. We just got some test results, standardized test results in Maryland showing kids across the board, across the state, aren't doing so well on this new standardized test. If that's your one measure, if that's your metric. But how do you improve education? What do you say to people who say, we've been spending a ton of money on education in this state, And most of the state's been doing pretty well for the last several years. You know, Maryland gets pretty high ratings on public education. It's Baltimore City that's the problem.
The state's dropped five spots in the national rankings since Hogan's been in office. My children go to school in the Montgomery County Public Schools. It's where their mom lives, and folks are nervous down there. And Montgomery County is supposed to be like the richest county in the state. There's concern across the state. I've now traveled to 20 counties, and I've yet to go to one. You know, this is in 3 months of being a candidate. I've been to 20 counties, most of those at least twice, many of them a dozen times. I have yet to have a meeting where somebody doesn't raise concern about the schools. In Maryland, we expect to have the best schools in the country, and we no longer do. The reality is that our state's own consultants came back and told the Kerwin Commission that we're underfunding our schools by $2.6 billion, which is why, you know, I can't understand why I'm the only candidate out here saying that the casino money and the lottery money actually has to be used to supplement our historic sources of funding for our schools. It only gets us a third of the way towards where, or maybe even just 25% of the way towards where the consultants say that we need to be. But let's just agree, that promise was made to voters. We need to keep it. And while we might quibble, Dan, over whether it's $1.5 billion or it's $2.5 billion, I think we can all stipulate on the first $700 million, $800 million that we need to start that funding now. That would pay for better salaries for our teachers so that we can recruit and retain the best teachers in the country, better training for them as well. It would pay for universal pre-K. It would make it possible for us to, you know, frankly, build on the success of Bard College here or PG Community College, Prince George's Community College, both of which have found ways to put 2 years of college education into high school. And it would also allow us to begin putting 2 years of a four-year trade apprenticeship program into high school, because we do have these discouraged, disconnected, you know, older boys becoming young men who don't believe that college is the way for them. I mean, we've watched it now for generations. But if you can show them that, yeah, as an electrician, you can make $100,000 a year, well, they might stay in high school to get on that path.
If things continue as they are right now with the Affordable Care Act as it's applied in Maryland, we could be looking at a very large bill for Medicaid to maintain insurance for poor people or people just above the poverty line who get Medicaid. That's a big problem up ahead if Congress doesn't do something, if the president doesn't help.
Worse than that, if Trump makes another go-round at Trump Care, we could see healthcare systems in our inner cities and in our rural areas implode. Folks in Garrett County, Allegheny County say that it's half their economy and the local hospital could fail if Obamacare is taken away. We need to deal with our kind of health care crisis in our state, which is a crisis right now. We got almost 300,000 people who don't have health care, both as a moral crisis, as a health crisis, but also as a crisis in our economy. It's the leading cause of bankruptcy. And I think folks like to believe, because it's so terrifying when you think about what can happen to somebody who lacks health care, that it's somebody else's problem. But I got to tell you, man, I was in Montgomery County at a union meeting, and I disclosed that as a child I had a seizure disorder, and there were periods when I was 2 and there were periods when I was 20, didn't have health care coverage, and my parents feared I might die because I couldn't get it was hard to get access to the meds I needed. In fact, there was a time when a doctor had to steal them for months on end for me because I was an organizer and I had no health care, and he just believed in what I was doing, and so he would make sure I got my meds. And somebody came up crying afterwards, sobbing, and they ultimately disclosed to me that their girlfriend, who's a 52-year-old psychologist, world-renowned in her field, had hit a little gap in her life where she didn't have health care coverage, and she couldn't get her meds, and she had an epileptic seizure, and she died 5 days earlier. Turns out that this woman in Montgomery County, her father runs a hospital's med center in upstate New York, and he asked this man, white-collar professional in Montgomery County, this woman's boyfriend, to send him his daughter's death certificate. And he said, yeah, you know, that's the technical reason my daughter died, asphyxiation from an epileptic seizure. But let's be honest, she's no longer with us because she couldn't afford health care at this point in her life. And you're talking about a white woman with multiple degrees in Montgomery County dying of lack of access to health care. I think we can all just admit this is all of our friendship networks. It's all of our families. That there's nobody who's not touched in some way by this crisis, and we have to solve it. It's just not You know, acting, because we have jobs where, you know, healthcare is tied to it, like it's not our concern, really ignores our responsibility as citizens, as leaders, as neighbors. And for those of us who are faith, it's full of faith, who believe that we actually have to treat our neighbors as ourselves, however our faith may say
it. I'm with you on that, but it's as if Maryland has to solve this problem on its own.
Well, that's
under
just
current
it.
Conditions in Washington.
You know, that's just it. And and this will have to be the last question because I got to.
Was that?
I said,
I didn't know we were timed.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, we've got to be, I think, at Johns Hopkins. Right?
All right.
Yeah.
Let's just wrap this up. Let
I'm
me
sorry.
Just go back to my
yeah.
question.
Yeah.
It seems like Maryland might have to solve the problem on its own, come up with its own money to keep this going under current conditions in Washington.
I absolutely believe that Maryland must have a plan to provide health care to all of its residents, no matter what happens in Washington. I'm kind of done with, you know, waiting to see if Donald Trump comes to his senses. Similarly, I think we can't wait for Congress to act. And that's why I've asked some of the best health economists in the country to figure out how we do it in our state. It's the leading cause of bankruptcy. We have hundreds of thousands of people who don't have access to it right now. People are dying untimely deaths. Children are being orphaned. And we may end up with hundreds of thousands of more without health care if Donald Trump has his way. It would be irresponsible for anybody running for governor not to be actively engaged in figuring out how we solve this for our entire state.
Hey, one last thing. People might say, well, he's got a lot of great ideas. He's
sure.
got a lot of passion. You ran the NAACP
Correct.
For how many years? So you do have some nuts and bolts running an organization experience.
I've been a CEO or a partner in a business since I was 26 years old. I have as much or more executive experience than anybody in this race. And frankly, I didn't get my executive experience as having already become a politician. I got it the old-fashioned way, running organizations, building businesses, being accountable. What folks can expect from me as a seasoned leader who cut his teeth running organizations and helping to grow businesses is that when it's time to have a tough conversation with voters, I will stipulate that everybody in the conversation is an adult and be willing to have a tough conversation with love. Frankly, that's what we've needed to do in education in our state for a long time. But most politicians would rather rob Peter to pay Paul and kick the can down the road. You just can't do that. It short circuits your kids today in ways that they'll be struggling with their entire lives. And more importantly, perhaps for some who are concerned just about the bottom line, more importantly, for those who are fixated just on the economic bottom line, it short circuits our state's economy tomorrow. So whether you do it for reasons of morality or you do it for reasons of profitability as a state, and from a business perspective, we've got to get to a place where we're willing to have tough conversations with love as a state about our priorities and make sure that we're creating a better future for all our kids rather than short circuiting the future for most of them.
Okay, Ben, thank you very much.
Appreciate you, brother. Good to see you.
Okay. Former NAACP President Ben Jealous is a partner in KPOR Capital, a company with a social mission founded by California entrepreneurs and philanthropists Mitch KPOR and Frieda KPOR Klein. The firm claims that 56% of its investments have gone to companies started by women or persons of color. Before joining KPOR Capital, Ben Jealous served for 5 years as president and CEO of the NAACP. Be listening for more candidates' interviews in the coming months on Roughly Speaking. Next up, another Democrat seeking his party's nomination for governor to run against Larry Hogan, tech entrepreneur and author Alec Ross. That's our show for now. If you have questions or comments, drop me a line at droddricks@baltsun.com. Please review us on iTunes if you get a chance. And I hope you'll tell your friends, neighbors, and relatives, maybe your dentist, about Roughly Speaking. They can subscribe to this podcast via the podcast app on your iPhones, iPads, or iPod Touches. On Android devices, search for the podcast via Stitcher Radio, Beyond Pod, or Pocket Casts. And on computers, subscribe through iTunes or BaltimoreSun.com. Our theme music is composed by Jeff Truman of High Gravity Sounds in Fells Point in Baltimore. The producer is Steve Early in the Baltimore Sun newsroom. This is Dan Roderick. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.